I come to you this evening not as an expert in the disease of chemical dependency, but as someone who has increasingly become concerned about this disease and its impact upon the lives of so many people. And as a member of the Task Force on Chemical Dependency for the Ohio Synod of the Lutheran Church in America, and a member of the Task Force on Chemical Dependency for Trinity Lutheran Seminary. And what I will be doing is speaking a bit out of my experience in those particular contexts, and leaving some time for you to respond and ask questions and the like, and for me to be able to point you to some resources far beyond myself that I think will be of real help to you if you'd like to get further information about this disease and its many dimensions, and it particularly in its shared aspect in the dimensions of codependency. Well, what do we mean, first of all, by chemical dependency? The word chemical is used because such dependencies are not only include dependency upon alcohol, but upon other mood-altering or mind-altering substances, including illegal drugs and legal prescription drugs. And sometimes the drug dependency that is affecting people is one that is perfectly legal and is not understood to be at all a matter or of a real issue or problem, because the addiction is to medically prescribed drugs. But it is a dependency upon these chemicals that eventually becomes both physical, psychological, and emotional, even spiritual. And this is what we want to take a look at, and also to see, as I said, that this disease also becomes a matter of codependency on the part of the persons that are closely attached to the person with the disease primarily, has the primary disease. There are secondary and dependent effects as well. I've been talking about chemical dependency as a disease. That is not the way in which it has been understood until fairly recently. People who exhibit drug-dependent behavior are seen very often as persons who have very little willpower, who are basically immoral or insensitive or uncaring, that they are self-indulgent, and that if they would only exercise some control and some willpower, they would be able to resolve their problem and stop causing problems to persons close to them. In the past, the only way in which people concerned about chemical dependency could see a solution was to call upon people to abstain from the use of such chemicals, particularly the use of alcohol. And so on the frontier of the United States, for example, alcoholism was a great scourge. It often was a matter of life and death for families, where the homesteading a male in the family would become involved in alcoholism, and his wife and children could be in a situation of incredible jeopardy because he was not providing for them and was not adequate in seeing to their needs. And there were no social welfare programs in those days. So it's rather interesting to note that when the revival preachers came through the frontier of Ohio, which was the frontier back in the 1820s, 1830s, they preached religious conversion. And for those who became religiously converted and involved themselves in the life of the church, there were two pledges that people were called upon to take at that point. And one was a pledge of abstinence from alcohol, and the other one was a pledge to become involved in the abolitionist movement, which is really interesting, because those were seen as signs of the regenerated life. And this was the way that the church could best respond to the problem of alcoholism as it encountered it at that time. And, of course, we're all familiar with the attempt on the part of American society to have an experiment in prohibition, prohibiting the sale of alcohol in order to, again, put pressure on its use and in that way try to curtail the effects of alcoholism. But it is more recently that we have come to understand that what we are dealing with here is a disease. It is a disease that is very subtle, very cunning, and very baffling. Researchers are still working on it. The dimensions of the disease are only beginning to be understood. But increasingly, there is recognition that what we are dealing with here is a disease. The basic characteristic of the disease is precisely the fact that the person who has the disease does not have control over it. And it is precisely recognizing that fact and dealing with that fact that is the first step toward the possibility of recovery. Now, in this respect, there is incredible suffering on the part of those who suffer from the disease. Usually these are people who are filled with incredible amounts of self-criticism. They are persons who have very low self-esteem, persons who are genuinely repentant. When an alcoholic or a drug dependent person says, after a moment of confrontation and struggle, "I swear that I will never touch a drop again, I will never use again," and so forth, I think that you can probably understand and assume that those people actually mean it. They really do mean it. But the point is they do not have control over their usage as normal people do. And therefore they are not able to live up to that longing that they have to be able to control their using or their drinking. In this respect, you can imagine the frustration and the disruption that this causes to people close to the drug-dependent person. Members of the immediate family are caught up in an incredible turmoil, an emotional and relational whirlwind. People who care about the using person try everything in the book to try to get them to stop, pleading, threatening, doing everything except standing on their head and spinning nickels to try and get this person to shape up and stop using. And the point is that regardless of how much the love and care and concern of others enters into the picture, it cannot bring about any change in the drug-dependent person. So that just as the drug-dependent person is helpless in regard to the chemical that's being used, and most chemical dependency in this country is alcoholism, even as the drug-dependent person has no control over the substance, all these people close to the drug-dependent person have no control over the ill individual. And that is a lesson that is just as hard for concerned people to learn as it is for the drug-dependent person to learn that he or she does not have control over the substance itself. And so that recovery from the disease, therefore, involves not only the drug-dependent person beginning with the first step, recognizing helplessness in the face of the disease, it also requires that all those who are intricately and intimately related to the drug-dependent person have to also recognize the fact that they do not have any control over the other person and over that disease. Just as people close to the drug-dependent person, such as a spouse or parents or children or siblings a boss at work or co-workers or close personal friends or the neighbor next door or the pastor, even as these persons try all sorts of maneuvers, tactics, advice, cajoling, threatening, informing, being patient with, and so forth and so on, none of their pleading or threatening will ever do anything. So the drug-dependent person will often try to control the disease, trying a variety of tactics. They'll cut back, they'll actually be able to abstain for a while, but it doesn't last. They will change drinking patterns, for example, or change what they're drinking. Well, I won't drink rye anymore, I'll drink scotch. No, I won't drink scotch, I'll drink gin. No, I won't drink anything hard, I'll just drink beer, I'll just drink wine. I mean, trying all sorts of maneuvers. I'll drink differently, I'll only drink on the weekends, or I won't have a drink before 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, trying all sorts of strategies to try to control usage. But the primary sign of what constitutes drug dependency is precisely that, namely loss of control. So if we wanted to put a profile of disease up on the board, that would be the first thing to list. No control. That's the difference between a drug-dependent person showing up at a party and someone else who just uses alcohol socially. People will experiment with drugs, especially alcohol, in our society, and people will know, well, I can handle two drinks, and then that's my limit. So if I'm going off to a party, I recognize there's going to be a lot of drinking going on. I get my two drinks, and I'm just going to stretch it out. And usually the way in which we can metabolize the alcohol is about the equivalent of one shot an hour. After an hour's time, the alcohol in that shot has been transformed chemically into sugar in the system and is taken care of by bodily processes. So without even realizing that or knowing that medically, people will just moderate and engage their drinking, and people will come foisting drinks on them. I'll have another. No, I'm fine. I'm doing just fine. Thanks anyway, and so forth and so on. They know how to control their drinking. The drug-dependent person will go to the same party with the same assumption. Well, I'm certainly not going to get loaded tonight. I'm not going to cause any problems. I'm going to have my two drinks and just have a good time and enjoy being with people, and I'm going to go home. And then the next thing you know, they wake up and realize that they're back in their own bed. They didn't realize how they got there. It's the next day, and they don't remember anything. They remember the two drinks or maybe three drinks, and then it starts to get blurry, and beyond that, they don't know anything. That is precisely the sign of someone who has this disease. They do not have control. Once they start using that substance, it's the triggering mechanism, and they're right into it. And sometimes people don't realize that something odd is going on, assuming, well, everybody has blackouts. You know, everybody goes off and has something to drink, and then they can't remember what happened. I mean, that's just natural, isn't it? I mean, everybody is that way. Of course, everybody isn't that way. That's a rather abnormal phenomenon, to have a blackout. That indicates that something is going on and something is wrong. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that this disease, how do you know, if somebody said, how do you know if you have problems drinking or problems using other drugs? One of the simplest explanations that I've ever heard is, you have a problem if it causes problems. It's that simple. If your drinking or using causes you any kind of a problem, you have a problem. If it keeps getting in the way of the rest of your life. If you discover that you're so hungover that you can't get to work, and it's interfering with your getting to work and maintaining your job security, you've got a problem. If it's you suddenly discover that you're out of the stuff and you're sort of saying, my goodness, I wonder if the liquor store is open, and no, it isn't. Well, I wonder if I can call up a friend and they might have something. I mean, this is really rather bizarre behavior when you think about it. I mean, would you do this for a can of tomato juice? Would you do this for a box of frozen broccoli? You know, if something like that is going on, you've got a problem. If the effects of the drinking are such, is starting to cause friction between family members, and people are getting concerned and upset, you've got a problem. If you feel guilty about your using, if you feel guilty about it, you've got a problem. So the simplest way to deal with the question, am I suffering from chemical dependency, is ask yourself the question and answer it. Is it causing you problems? If it's causing you problems, you've got a problem. Now, the next thing we ought to say about the disease is that it is a primary disease. It is its own cause. There are some people who say, well, the reason I drink so much is, you know, I have this terrible job, or, you know, if you had my marriage, you know, you'd be drinking too, or if you had my kids, or if you had my parents, or if you lived next door to these people, you'd have a problem too. there are indeed usually many, many problems in the family structure and the relational structure of a drug-dependent person. But those problems are all secondary problems. The primary problem is the using itself. Now, we sometimes hear people saying that. Well, no wonder he drinks. I mean, if you had a nagging, shrewish wife like that, you know, you'd be drinking too. Well, the point is, most probably the reason she became nagging and shrewish was her frustration over the fact of his drinking and what's happening. So we often hand out all sorts of advice to people without knowing what's going on, and we begin to think that the drinking is actually caused by something other than itself. It is not caused by something other than itself. Chemical dependency is a primary disease, it's not a secondary disease. Not only is it primary, but it's chronic. It doesn't go away. It's once it's there, once it surfaces, you can expect it's going to be there. Now, there are many people who are drug dependent and who, for one reason or another, and by one means or another, heroically manage to get themselves away from the negative effects of that chemical, usually of alcohol, and don't go back to it again. And fine. But the point is that they can never expect to be able to drink later on in their lives and be able to do so at a social level. Now, there's some question about this. There's a little experimentation going on about this. But the overwhelming argument seems to be that if you have this disease, you have it for life. In fact, there's evidence that seems to indicate that someone who is in trouble with alcohol, say they begin to recover at age 30, they don't touch another drop until they're 55, and they start using alcohol again, the state of their disease at age 55 will then pick up at the point the same as if they had been continuing to drink and have that disease progress from the time they stopped to the time they started. The picking up the drinking again will cause a reaction such that it is as if they had been drinking all the time. So that it shows that we're dealing with something very, very strange and baffling here. But it is a chronic disease. What's more, it's a degenerative disease. It keeps getting worse. It doesn't simply go away, or it isn't something that is simply arrested and then levels off. It is a disease in which the state of the individual gets worse and worse and worse until finally, and this is the last thing we have to say about it in this particular cluster of issues, it is a fatal disease. The end result is death. Chemical dependency is the third leading cause of death in adults in the United States, after heart disease and cancer. It is number three cause of death. Usually that's not written on the death certificate. It doesn't say they died of chemical dependency, but all sorts of secondary and subsidiary effects of what is going on in their life, that ends up actually causing death. The better way to illustrate this is by pointing out it is estimated to be the leading cause of death among adolescents. The leading cause of death among adolescents is chemical dependency. But you don't see that written on the death certificate. Instead, you see written on the death certificate something like suicide. Or else you see something like death from multiple fractures in a car accident. Half of the automobile accidents in this country are alcohol-related. Half of them. And this is the abuse of alcohol, and even beyond abuse, it is tied into not just misuse or abuse, but to addiction to alcohol. And suicide is usually closely linked. Remember that shocking story that came out, when was it, this past spring, of those teenagers in New Jersey, the suicide pact and so forth. If you read between the lines, anybody who's aware about chemical dependency, there are students who are loners or on the outside, who are depressed, they're not doing well in school. There's a lot of depression. One of their friends committed suicide, and then this group, four of them get in the car, was it four, I believe, got into the car and shut the door and turned on the engine of the car and died of carbon monoxide poisoning. From what was given out in the news, you knew these kids were chemically dependent kids. This disease has dimensions that are physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual. The physical dimensions of the disease are perhaps the most intriguing, the most interesting. There are all kinds of studies going on right now. Let me just cite a few things. In Sweden, for example, there's very close tabulation kept about adoption cases. The Swedish authorities have discovered that they have kept records and noted that the children of alcoholic parents who have been adopted by non-alcoholic families have a much higher than average chance of being alcoholic themselves. This seems to indicate that a primary issue at stake here is not environmental, it is not relational, it is not nurturing, it is a matter of the physiology of the individuals involved. Another set of studies shows something very interesting. The number of persons that are alcoholic in the general population and the general age at which members of those populations become alcoholic is markedly different in differing cultures. What is interesting is that the longer ago a culture was introduced to alcohol, the fewer the number of alcoholics in that culture today, and the later the onset of the disease in the population, so that there are not that many Italian or Jewish alcoholics. And when Italians and Jews become alcoholic, they tend to become alcoholic later on in their lives. In other words, the alcohol actually becomes a problem for them later on, in midlife. That's generally speaking. We're not talking about always and everywhere, but across the board. With Germanic peoples, that's less so. There is a larger percentage of alcoholics in the general population, and the alcoholism tends to set in earlier in life. With Celtic and Slavic peoples, it's even a greater percentage of the population and an even earlier period of onset. And it's interesting to note that as far as they're able to tell historically, alcohol was introduced into those populations much later. But the clearest evidence of this is what happens to Native American and Eskimo populations here in North America. They were introduced to alcohol when white people came to this continent. So it was Native Americans in the Eastern Seaboard that were introduced to alcohol in the 17th and 18th centuries, the majority of them in the 19th centuries and the 20th centuries. The proportion of alcoholics in those populations is much higher, and the onset is much earlier. There are records of a Native American kid who had a blackout at the age of 10 drinking his first beer. This 10-year-old kid drank a beer and had a blackout, couldn't remember what happened, just total amnesia. What this suggests is that, of course, it stands to reason that as centuries would go on in the use of alcohol, you could imagine that those who had the disease would have less and less chance to reproduce their own kind. They would tend to die off before they got to child-rearing years. You start having kids that are 10, 12, 15 years old, alcoholics, there's a good chance they're going to suffer the accidents, they're going to be dead before they themselves have kids, and so forth and so on. So this is one of the theories. It's only that at this point, but it's very interesting to note how this works. Other studies studying the brain tissues of alcoholics at Walter Reed Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C., seems to suggest that physiologically something happens to people's brains. Something is going on, the alcohol causes a reaction, it doesn't happen in normal people. It's a baffling, strange business, but there does seem to be a physical or physiological basis But it also is emotional and psychological. In many instances, as I will point out in just a minute, people become chemically dependent who are trying to deal with feelings, a lot of negative feelings. Feelings of pain, feelings of inadequacy, feelings of inferiority, feelings of shame, feelings of loneliness, a lot of negative stuff going around, not knowing how to deal with those negative feelings. What happens is that when they take the drug, especially alcohol, they have a feeling of euphoria. It is a mood change. They feel released from all of that. We all know about, Uncle Charlie, who's such a quiet, mousy guy, and you give him a couple of drinks, and he's wearing the lampshade, and he's the life of the party, and you wonder where that came from. You know, Uncle Charlie really has a lot going for him. We didn't realize that. That's the mood swing. The alcohol actually sort of liberates the psyche, and people just sort of come out of themselves, and for that length of time, quote unquote, are feeling good, or feeling no pain, as we say, feeling no emotional or psychological pain or any inhibitions. What happens, however, if this becomes a chronic pattern, usually the results of the behavior that results from overindulging in alcohol are such that it makes the person feel humiliated, ashamed, isolated, accused, guilty, and all the rest of it. In other words, what it produces is a lot of negative feelings. So then what does the person do in dealing with the negative feelings? To use again in order to get feeling good. And then what happens as a result of the behavior that comes out of that quote-unquote feeling good or feeling no pain is again a lot of negative feelings, and there you have the cycle. And it perpetuates itself. And what tends to happen is that the addictive person needs more and more and more of the drug, more and more of the alcohol to feel good, and there increasingly is the connection to physical dependency. And after a while, then you have persons who need to have a drink, an eye-opener in the morning just in order to face the day, and they're not getting any mood change after a while. In other words, the mood change is not a positive one. They're just trying to maintain and cope. And that is a drug-dependent person that's really in a sad way. What is also the case in regard to this drug is that it is incurable. There is nothing that we know that can be done to cure the person of the disease. If you have the disease, you have it for life. It will never go away. And the only result is, if the disease is not arrested, the results are going to be fatal. There is, however, the possibility of arresting the disease, the possibility of what is called recovery from the disease. So people don't say that they are cured of alcoholism. They talk about they are recovering alcoholics. The disease can be stopped. Its negative effect can be stopped. But that can only happen through a very specific program of treatment. And in this regard, what is needed is one of the major elements of this disease is, one of its significant features is denial. Someone said, alcoholism is a disease, busy saying that it isn't a disease. It's like somebody having TB and denying that there's anything wrong. Everybody coughs. I mean, don't you cough? Herman, don't you cough? I mean, I cough. I mean, everybody coughs, right? I mean, what's wrong with coughing? So there's a little coughing every now and then. You know, what's the problem? I mean, we'd say, that's insane. That's exactly right. There is insanity to this disease. It does not recognize that it is a disease. Usually the last person to recognize that there is a real problem is the alcoholic. Everybody else knows the problem. Everybody else sees there is aberrant behavior here. Everyone else sees that this is not normal. The last person to recognize this and admit it is the alcoholic. Therefore, what is needed is, in order to break through the denial and get persons into recovery, one of the most helpful things to know about is intervention. knowing how to break through that pattern of denial and get that person into treatment. Now, there's no guarantee that treatment will work. There are persons who have gone through treatment, come out the other side, and they've been fine for a while, and then they're back in their addictive behavior again. There are persons who have to go through treatment 4, 5, 6 times before it finally catches hold. There are others who go through treatment once, and it catches hold then. But what is absolutely primary is the recognition and admission on the part of the person that they indeed have the disease, and that's the most difficult thing for the person to admit. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult is because by this time, the drug has become such an important friend. It's what enables the person to cope, to get along in life. I mean, things are miserable. I mean, look at my family life. Look at my marital life. It's falling apart at the seams. There's always these fights and conflicts and so forth. I've got to get through that. How else can I handle that except by, you know, having a couple of shots? Things are really bad at work. My boss keeps ragging me, you know. I don't know. And I'm always under the gun there. The only way to handle that is, you know, my friend, the bottle, and so forth and so on. I'm feeling terrible about myself. I take a couple of shots. I feel a lot better. You're going to take my best friend away from me? What are you doing to me? I'm not going to let this go. So that is part of the psychology of what's involved. And therefore, it is very difficult for the person to recognize that the therapy is going to make them feel healthy again and get things moving in a more positive direction is precisely to break through that pattern of denial and to break through the dependency upon the drug in order to feel good and to cope. And therefore, it requires intervention. And that has to be done very carefully. That has to be done by people knowing what they're doing. And it can be done in a variety of ways. But what is needed is precisely getting that person into the possibility of treatment center. I've even heard chemical dependency counselors say, if you have to get the person drunk to get them to the treatment center, get them drunk to get them to the treatment center. The conditions under which the person enters treatment and the attitude they have when they enter treatment does not at all indicate how the treatment actually is going to work once they're in the treatment program. I mean, it may be the person who's the most resistant and the most arguing and the one that you have to get drunk, you know, in the car, where they don't know what they're doing, to get into the treatment center may actually respond to the treatment, or someone who goes willingly may not. That is an unknown quantum. That is something that finally is something that is part and parcel of the inner dynamics of that person and their willingness to accept responsibility for their disease. And then the final thing, I think, I'm not going to deal with this latter part because I do want to leave time for discussion. The final thing is that this is a codependent disease. I've already indicated something about that. What it means is that other people are affected by the disease because they're affected by the attitude and the dynamics of interrelationship on the part of the person who has the disease primarily. And they become equally caught up in unhealthy patterns of behavior and interaction. There are even some codependent people who become emotionally hung up on being the quote-unquote saving person in regard to the ill person, the person who has the disease. And then a spouse especially is vulnerable, assuming I'm going to be the martyr, I'm going to be the saint, I'm going to be the hero, I'm going to cover things up, I'm going to smooth things out, I'm going to be loving and understanding. And the next thing you know, the spouse is hooked on the unhealthy dynamics of the relationship with a sick person, and they themselves become emotionally sick. And so recovery from the disease of chemical dependency means recovery not only on the part of the person who has the disease primarily, but also recovery on the part of those who are codependents, who are very closely and intricately and intimately related with the drug-dependent person because they have developed patterns of self-understanding, patterns of behavior and interrelationship patterns that are also very unhealthy. And those patterns have to be broken just as the pattern of drug dependency has to be broken. At this point, let me stop because I think that we ought to have some sharing and some response. And as I said, I don't claim to be an expert. Please note those books up that I have listed at the top of the board there, Ann Wilson Schaff, Codependency, Vernon Johnson, I'll Quit Tomorrow. Those are two very fine resources for you if you want to learn more about this disease in its primary and secondary or or immediate dependent and codependent forms. Yes?
I want you to talk a little bit more about intervention. You've said that something that has to be done by people that know what they're doing. How does one get to that point? Suppose you have a family where there is an alcoholic family member, and the other family members recognize the need to do something. What do they do? Where do they start? How do they become capable of bringing about an intervention?
I think the first thing to do is to get a hold of someone who is a chemical dependency counselor, usually at a treatment center nearby, or even to talk to someone in the local chapter or local headquarters of AA or Al-Anon, to get you to the resource person. But get to a chemical dependency counselor and say, we'd like to arrange an intervention. That person will help you set it up. It can be done in a variety of ways. And the more people that are in on it, the better. Their close family members, say some close friends, and maybe even some people at work. Suddenly the person, they don't know about it. I can talk about what we've done at Trinity Seminary, where we have had interventions with students. Students have come into a room, they've not known what's waiting for them. Suddenly they walk in, and here's a spouse, and here's two friends, and here's the pastor at the MIC assignment, as we call it, Trinity, the Ministry and Context assignment, and here's a professor, and then there's, you know, here's what we note. We see this happening, we see this happening. And a sharing of feelings, and the spouse saying, I really feel troubled, and I feel upset, and I feel concerned about you, and I see this happening. And talking about specific things, talking about very specific things. Sometimes leading up to intervention, what is often suggested is keeping a journal. When there's aberrant behavior, when there are things that are obviously weird and so forth, write it in a journal, keep it there. Keep it between those pages, and then when the time of intervention comes, there's the journal. You say, you know, on November 3rd, this is what happened. You remember that party you went to? Or remember what happened then? And so forth. You deal with specifics and say that here is our concern. We think that you may, in fact, be suffering from the disease of alcoholism or other forms of chemical dependency, and we want you to really have this checked out. We don't know, and this is really speaking the truth, we don't know if in fact you have this disease, but we really suspect there's something strange going on here, and you're hurting yourself and you're hurting us, and you're hurting your future, and we want you to go in and have yourself checked out. Will you do it? And the point is to have the telephone there and have them make the phone call right then and have the treatment center already lined up knowing that they're going to be called. And that's how it works. I mean, that's one pattern. But the best is to get professional advice.
Can I throw another wrinkle into it? And I don't want to go take all the time on this, but what if this, in the situation none of the family members are local? So that there really isn't anybody local that can keep the journal, that can arrange for the room and all that sort of thing. Do you have any kind of advice about that?
My only response would be, I'm just thinking imaginatively here. I mean, I'm no expert, as I said, but I would think, how about the people who are being affected, who are close to that individual? It may be that there are significant family members at a distance who would be willing to come, who do have a suspicion and do have a concern and are willing to pay a couple hundred dollars to come. Just imagine the effect of that. I mean, here's your sister that's flown in from Palm Beach, Florida, just to be there. I mean, obviously there's got to be some real concern and some real love if they're willing to pay that kind of money to come and just see you and say, I'm really concerned. So maybe even distance at that point becomes an asset rather than a liability. I don't know. But I think, again, always get the advice of a professional. They're the ones to help you best. Karen, you had a question, and then we'll go over here.
I just wondered if you'd comment on the, we tend to hear a lot about how interventions are only for when the person files it out. You know, that you have to wait till they're laying in the gutter somewhere and
no.
Invested.
No, thank you for mentioning that. No, on the contrary, interventions are part of what is called raising the bottom. In other words, instead of waiting to the person getting to a point where they're just absolutely in despair, where they are just totally broken down, where life really is falling apart from them, where they can't function anymore, where they've lost their job and they can't hold any work, instead of waiting for them to hit bottom and then maybe, you know, that an intervention might help then. On the contrary, the process of intervention can, as it were, raise the bottom. In other words, showing that person the negative effects of their behavior and sharing with that person one's feelings about what's going on, and suggesting and recommending that person go into treatment. Now at Trinity Seminary, we have the pressure, and I'll talk about this tomorrow, we have a policy statement in place, we have the pressure that the students know that if they don't go in for treatment, there's a good chance they may be dismissed from the seminary. And the same holds true for staff and faculty. If there's a faculty person who is approached in this regard, that if they will not have themselves checked out when there seems to be considerable concern on the part of a lot of people across the board, that they see some symptoms, that they then can be, in fact, be dismissed from the faculty. So there is the use of pressure. Why? Because one has to break through the power of that denial. Now, again, it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't claim to be omniscient in this regard, and I remember one intervention in which I was involved, in which I was asked to be involved, in which there seemed to be some reasonable possibility this person was chemically dependent. They went through the initial screening process at the seminary with a clinical psychologist who's a member of the faculty. The evidence there said this is coherent with a dependent personality, a compulsive personality, and that this required checking out in a treatment center. The person went into the treatment center, they were checked out, they were discovered they were not chemically dependent, but they did have other dependency problems. And then that person was asked to deal with those dependency problems.
What do you mean by that? What are other dependency problems?
Well, there can be all sorts of dependency problems. Other addictions. Let me just pull out my notes here. One of the most interesting ones, and this is opening up a can of worms, but one of the more interesting and the more prominent ones is workaholism. I mean, it's socially, not only socially acceptable, it's socially approved and encouraged. This hardworking person, you know, the person who never can take a day off, never can relax, never can do anything, you know, and sit down and just take it easy. Coming up here to Holden Village is just absolutely terrible because, I mean, my Lord, I can't be busy puttering, doing something, you know, or keeping, staying at work, you know, beyond the hours and going on the weekends and so forth. That is compulsive behavior. That's really strange and addictive behavior. And usually it's emotionally related. It's a way of people trying to feel good about themselves. You can be addicted to all sorts of things. Money, wealth, power, success syndrome. One can be addicted to sex. There's such a thing now as Sexaholics Anonymous. People whose sexual expression is not healthy and it is compulsive. People who are addicted to food, Overeaters Anonymous, for example, deals with people who have real problems with food. They don't eat food just to satisfy hunger. They feel they eat food in order to feel good about themselves. And they're involved in a lot of negative feelings about themselves. And many times their overeating makes them feel negative about themselves, and there's the vicious cycle there. So there are a variety of addictive behaviors. Including some who say there's even addiction to unhealthy religion, and I think that that's something that we can explore too. But there's a kind of religious addiction, and one now has a Fundamentalist Anonymous around, interestingly enough.
Doesn't the codependent have to be treated at the same time?
No, the codependent does not have to have treatment at the same time if they refuse to enter into it. The recovery let's just do alcoholism. The recovery of the alcoholic is not dependent upon what is going on in the home. The recovery of the alcoholic is in the hands of the alcoholic alone, and that's also part of the recovery program. You must accept responsibility for your own condition, and you cannot blame anybody else, and you cannot look to anybody else. Yes, it will be a dysfunctional relationship. And many times as the alcoholic gets better, the codependent gets worse. I mean, the marital situation or the family situation gets worse because there's a person recovering. And the other one is still trapped in codependent behavior. So that's where codependents are always encouraged to go to something like Al-Anon for spouses, or to go to Al-Ateen for teenagers, Al-Atats for children, or Families Anonymous for the parents of addictive children. So that that they engage in a process of recovery at the same time. So it is helpful if each are in their own recovery program and work their own program, but the point is they've got to work their own program. And there are others the other way too. There are persons who are in Al-Anon and Families Anonymous where their kids or spouses are not yet involved in a recovery program. But yes, it's more helpful if both are recovering together. That's true. But it is not necessary. In fact, you cannot expect the other person to accept responsibility for your own feelings, your own behavior and your own dysfunctional interaction, your disease.
Let me ask you, I think there comes a point in the condition of trying to get an alcoholic into treatment over and over again, you do get them over and over again, 6 or 8 or 10 times. Do you think there comes a point where you might as well give up on it?
Yes. I think that's right. I think that's right, because people do get worn down, and I think that's quite right, and those are indeed some of the negative consequences that the alcoholic is then bringing on himself or herself. If indeed they keep falling back into the pattern, for family members to keep picking up the pieces and so forth may in fact be a form of just enabling, as it's called, enabling the disease to perpetuate itself. It may be some very severe consequences are needed before that person really begins to grab a hold of things. Some traumatic thing where, parents just say to the child, we don't want to see you again. Or there's a divorce that takes place, or they're fired from their work, or whatever it is. I mean, very powerful stuff in order to show precisely the negative character of the behavior of the disease. And so sometimes those consequences should be leveled, and people should not try to interfere. Like parents who interfere because the police have picked up their kids. Oh, quick, cover it up and try to, and don't let him, not spend a night in jail or something like that. On the contrary, let him experience the negative consequences of the choices they've made. The more they feel the more they feel the pain, the more the chance of intervention will really take place. But ultimately, you have no control over another person's disease. And that can be very sad and very painful. And that is one of the most painful yet necessary lessons that a codependent has to learn. So in the first step of the recovery program of AA is we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. In Families Anonymous, they bring out what really is more implicit in the other codependent programs. They say, we admitted that we were powerless over others' lives and that our lives had become unmanageable. And that's the point, is the admission of powerlessness. You are powerless over the drug. You are powerless over the other person who suffers from the disease. You are powerless, and you've got to admit that. And only when you make that first step of admission is there any chance for recovery on your own part. So, again, let me call these books to your attention. Those of you who'd like to know more about this, Vernon Johnson, the founder of the Johnson Institute in Minneapolis, an Episcopalian priest, I'll Quit Tomorrow, and Ann Wilson Schaff, who's also done some very interesting work in feminist awareness. Women's Reality is a famous book of hers. She's done an excellent job here in a book called Codependency. I recommend them both heartily to you if you want to learn further about it. Tomorrow I'll talk about Trinity Seminary's program and what we're doing as a community of Christians and as an academic community and as a seminary of the church in regard to this disease.